Welcome to the Connect You podcast, where we interview guests who have transformed their lives, whether in mind, body, health, or wealth. Connect You seeks to discover what drives people and makes them extraordinary. Brought to you by Lewis Jackson, who brings you exciting real-life stories, hot topics, and the truth.
Hi, guys, and welcome back to the Connect You podcast. On today's episode, we have Chris Sheeran. He has been an architectural designer, a commercial construction design and build manager, a project manager, and now he's working part-time as a property investor. Chris, it's great to have you on the show. Please introduce yourself.
Hi, thanks very much for bringing me on. I'm really touched by doing this for you, so thanks very much. Yeah, name's Chris Sheeran. As you said, I've had a varied career of 35 years in the construction industry. Started off as a designer, then went over to the dark side, as they say, to become a contractor, design manager, regional design manager, designer build manager, bid manager. In the recession, previous recession, I then left due to the recession and worked for a environmental and sustainability company, and then moved back to construction as a pre-construction bid manager, and was involved in a lot of development projects and things like that. So Carillion went bust with a lot of my pension. I decided that that was the catalyst for me to really start making money for myself and look after my future, because obviously, you know, bit of a interesting story, because obviously, you know, when I got divorced about 8 years ago, my wife took half my Carillion pension, and then when Carillion went bust, they took pretty much the rest of it. So it was a good point in my life to go, I need to start looking after my future and my kids and get a financial plan together.
So sorry about that, guys. It just muted a bit there. So just take me back to when you first went into the construction industry, Chris. Why did you want to go into that industry?
Okay, so I was working for Broadley Mallin Architects at the time, and I was an architectural technician, and I could see that my career was going to be limited. I wasn't a fully fledged architect. I was an architectural technician, and my career opportunities were limited. So I was always involved in doing the design and build projects. So when the architect passed over the scheme at planning permission, it might have been a school, a block of flats, a retail development, hotel, student accommodation. I was given the job to work with the design and build contractor to draw up all of the construction drawings. So I basically was then working often for design managers that were employed by the actual contractor and the client. So one day, pretty horrible design manager told me what I needed to do as the architectural designer, and I disagreed. And that was another catalyst, I think, in my career, because I naively thought then, if I left the industry and became what he was, I'd treat my architects and my builders better than he treated me. So I did that, and it all happened fairly quickly. So I ended up on a set of site cabins in a very cold, freezing cold Wiltshire, doing a tank servicing building for the MOD. So that was the start of my construction journey.
So what did he say to make you sort of go off on your own and start your own business?
Well, I left Broadley Mallin Architects, and I worked for a company that was called Higgs & Hill. That then Higgs & Hill turned into HBG contractors, and HBG turned into BAM. So you may have seen BAM around the country. They do lots of large scale developments. So I was working as a design coordinator for HBG. He basically said, this was in the recession now. So the emphasis or the power was all held at that time in the 1980s by the design and build contractors. It was a new thing. He basically said, I need you to downspec this building and redesign this, this, and this. Because I need to save money. And I said, well, I'm not too sure I want to do that because my bosses won't be very happy with that. He said, that's fine. We'll just sack you and get another architect because, you know, you need the money. We need the architect, but we've still got the job. You haven't. So it was a fairly cutthroat period when design and build started. And so I naively or genuinely thought that if I left architecture and moved into those kind of design and build roles, I would do a better job, of which I'd like to think I did. I always did. But the construction world's a lot tougher and harder than the architectural world.
So how have you found it moving from the recession to now?
So that was in the, I think that was late 80s, early 90s, I think it was. I then worked for Carillion on a large PFI scheme that was a new hospital development. So about 18 years ago, that was £150 million then, which would effectively be similar to what Bristol Broadmead Hospital was a couple of years back, which would be close to touching £500 million now. So that was a complicated design and build project. I was responsible for quite a number of the design packages, but I was also involved in the clinical design packages. So it was meeting with all the clinical doctors and designing all of their, or helping manage the design of all of their departments and things like that. So that was quite an interesting scheme.
Quite a high pressure and stressful job.
It was long hours. When I was working there, so I was close to my family. That was the thing that got me onto the job. It was keen to work to close my family. I had two kids under five. Although I was literally only 3 miles down the road, I was working 60 hours a week or more, if you see what I mean. It was a massively high pressure project. And the design managers at certain points were very much the critical path elements in terms of, if you don't get the design right to cost and time and program, then the building doesn't happen on time and cost. And that's fundamentally, you know, at that time, the construction cost was, I think, was just over the subcontractor packages was over £96 million. So there was a lot of stress. And the commercial world of contracting is an incredibly confrontational world. Mm. You know, people will have a cup of tea with you in the morning, have a chat to you, and then send you an email and put a claim in of 50, 100 grand, you know, and then have a chat to you later on in the afternoon. And it's all just part of the world, all part of the game. So it is a very difficult thing because there's big sums of money at risk, if you sort of mean, and big problems.
So is that potentially why it led to, I mean, you mentioned divorce earlier. Is that potentially why it led to that?
Yeah, so interestingly enough, what happened then was that the Swindon Hospital was happening. It was on site. I wanted to stay till the job finished, but being a design manager and being more upfront, I was moved to Wolverhampton. So, obviously, living in Swindon, Wolverhampton
quite a distance.
Isn't necessarily a local office to Swindon.
Yeah.
So I used to drive up there every day, hour and a half there, hour and a half back. Needed to be in the office at 7:45. Didn't finish till often 6 or 7 in the evening in the office, hour and a half drive back. I then started staying over the odd night. Then it ended up Monday to Friday. Then there was some big presentations, private finance, legal documents we had to do, work the weekend. And it got to the point where I think I was away for the best part of 2 weeks. So the email came through, you don't need to come home. I know the address. I'll send the papers to you. Just sign them. Bye. So that was a shot in the kind of,
yeah.
Right, okay, wake up now. And then I looked around me in Wolverhampton. We were all living a single guy's life. We were going out on the beer in the evenings. We were working hard. We were playing hard. But I looked around and realized that pretty much I was the only one that was probably left married out of these kind of teams. So I basically said to him, I've got to either leave or move me to a different job. So fair enough, fair play to Tarmac, as it was then, as it before it turned into Carillion, Tarmac Special Projects, PFI division. Moved down to another job, down low, which was in Tidworth. We were doing a redevelopment of a big military base. So there was 400 or 500 bedrooms or 1,000 bedrooms for the squaddies, redevelopment of theatres, offices, taking some old grade two listed building and making it into a fancy officer's mess. Everything was riddled in asbestos that was existing, and there was contamination in the ground everywhere. So it was quite a complicated job. And so then we did all of that. But then, so that was better. So I tried to get my marriage back on track. But, you know, you're moving from one high-pressure job to another high-pressure job. Okay, you might get home in 40 minutes, but it was still difficult. It was stressful. Being honest, I was quite angry quite a lot of the time. Didn't do the wife or the kids any good, which I think is a hang-up from, you know, my dad and my early relationship with my mum and dad, my younger days. So long story short, it didn't get any worse. The recession came. I moved jobs. Well, pretty much had to move jobs. It was either get made redundant or move jobs, if you sort of mean, move jobs. Worked from home, built my two-story extension on the side of the house whilst I was working from home, and built myself an office. And so I'd get up at 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning, drive 2-3 hours to the individual site I was doing, do the specialist report for air tightness, environmental issues, drive back 2 or 3 hours, do some paperwork, work on into the evening. But then the benefit was I saw the kids at home, which was great. But that changed the dynamic, because up until then they were something like, they were now 10 and 13 or something like that, maybe. Changed the dynamic. Obviously, she ruled the house. I wasn't there because I was working so much. I wanted to cook dinner. I wanted to hear what the kids had done at school. I wanted to be involved in the family. And of course, that completely changed the dynamic, changed the rules, changed the environment, which from my point of view, I was keen to do that. I wanted to get involved in my kids. I saw, although I'd lost 30 grand worth of salary, you know, a year. And we were living in this massive house with, you know, all the bits and pieces and everything else, semi-gated community, communal pool, the full work scenario, successful couple, whatever, you know. But I wanted to get involved in my kids. And that created more arguments, because obviously suddenly I wanted to try and get involved, and that was alien. And then a couple of years, a year or two later, she felt that things weren't working, went elsewhere, which I don't necessarily blame her for. Because I was we were both part of the problem, if you see what I mean. Marriage broke down, she had the affair. Long story short, we got divorced. She's now married the guy, which is good. At least, you know, she's happy and the kids are happy, stuff like that. And that was about 8 years ago now, I think. So it's all kind of changed. So yeah, it's been an interesting life, let's say. Lots happening.
Well, thank you for sharing that, Chris. A few things I want to pick up on from what you just told me. There's a lot to take from that. When you received the letter from your wife, obviously you're working away, you're providing for your family, or what you thought was the best thing to do at the time. As we all know, there's no rule book for that. When you received the letter or email, from your wife at that time, did it enter your head? That's it, I'm going to leave this job. I'm just going to go home and be.
Yeah, that's effectively what I did. I basically literally went into my manager's office and said, look, my wife is threatening to divorce me. It wasn't really a threatening. It was a more of a statement. She is going to divorce me. I said, no, nothing personal, guys, but, you know, to my manager. And I said, if we look around, you're all either single or divorced. I just don't want to join that club. Thanks. So
either.
So basically, yeah, I mean, you know, it wasn't as straightforward as it sounded, because I was working for the specialist private finance initiative team, which is all the high profile projects. They don't necessarily have one on your doorstep, and so actually the team I moved across, or actually moved from one side of the Wolverhampton office to the other side of Wolverhampton office for a couple of weeks until I could actually get down to Tidworth. But I basically said, you know, make a decision, because I'm going to leave the work and find another job unless you can move me to another position, move me to another job. And, you know, they did, thankfully, which I thought was going to sort a lot of the problems out. It did sort the problems out, because I wasn't working away. So I was always at home, got a chance to see the kids, tried to put them to bed sometimes, but in reality didn't. Ended up eating on my own on the kitchen table, as I think so many, you know, hardworking or long working hours dads do. Try to do as much as possible at the weekends. But it's, don't know, really. It was tough.
How did that make you feel? Because you mentioned the anger earlier.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of understand the stresses and the strains and you know, the anger and stuff that I've got, and I think I've released a lot of it now, and I'm not generally really angry in my new life now, if you see what I mean. But that was, I think it was, you know, my dad was an alcoholic. He basically drank and spoke himself to death. My mother was a fairly unemotional kind of person, hard as nails. Don't worry about it, love. Just get up and get on with it. Sort it out. Just get up and get on with it. So I've always been a task orientated person. I've always been a results based person. When I got divorced, I did quite a bit of research into kind of relationships and everything else. I wanted to learn what went wrong. Was it me? Was it her? And as ever, it's never one person. It's always a mixture of both, isn't it, really? You know, one of the things I learned, so if people are watching, I learned this. Well, I read this. I understand this. I still haven't necessarily mastered it. But for often blokes, it's all about the results. So get to the end. And if it's a good result, we all pat ourselves on the back and think it's great. So if any women are listening, put plenty of comments in after this podcast or whatever. The theory is that if the journey is so bad during that process, even though the result is good, it means that they hate the result because they've hated the journey so much. So when they look at the result, they don't look and go, wow, that's a great. For example, if it's a bathroom, if you're redoing up your bathroom or you're redoing your kitchen extension, if it's been an absolute nightmare for 2 years, but at the end of the day, it's the, I don't know if I'm allowed to say, the dog's bollocks, yeah?
Yes,
it's the best extension and kitchen and bathroom in the world, and you're really proud of it, but it's been an absolute pain in the ass to get there. Often, many women will look at it and go, I just hate this, because all this reminds me of is of the pain for the last 2 years. And most men can't get that. I've read it, I've understood it. I can't say I can implement it, but kind of, I have spoken to a couple of women when I read about this, and they went, yeah, that's totally right. And I went, I don't understand it. She went, well, you're a bloke, aren't you? You won't understand it. But yeah, that's an interesting theory.
Where did you read that?
I can't remember now. I've read a couple of books on relationships. I can't say I'm anywhere close to mastering any of them, really. But it's dead interesting psychological stuff. I don't think it's the Venus and Mars one. I think there was some other ones or whatever. So it's all about. And I think now more and more days, the mental health side is that we should really try and be in the moment and enjoy the journey more, which I think is a great set of words. But I think, well, I do definitely, I still struggle with that because I'm so results and task orientated, if you see what I mean. Learning, but, you know, still a long way to go. So I mean, I'm rabbiting on along here. I don't know if this is what, you know, your viewers want, if you see what I mean.
Listen, there's no right or wrong. There's no right or wrong here, Chris. It's what you've given out is absolutely amazing. I'm learning a lot from you. So honestly, don't fret at all. So you mentioned relationships earlier. A couple of points I want to touch on as well. The relationship with your mum and your dad, you mentioned that twice now.
Yeah.
So your dad was an alcoholic and your mum was sort of like this stern person.
Yes.
Like, just get up and get on with it.
Yes.
And that sort of moulded you into the person you are today.
Yeah, I mean, interestingly enough, good. You know, it has its goods and bads. I remember people talking to some of my mates or something. They said, well, if you want something to get done, get Chris to do it because he always delivers, you know, and it will always get done. He won't give up until it gets sorted. Although another downside in one of my careers was one of my bosses being interviewed said to his boss, the director, went, Chris is brilliant. He's got more innovation in his little finger than the majority of the whole of this organization. However, if you do employ Chris, he doesn't suffer fools and there will be casualties, which is not really very nice, but I'm not proud of that, but it's quite an interesting analysis of that's who I used to be, if you see what I mean, you know. I'd like to think I'm learning to be a lot more empathetic and a lot more emotionally aware of my effects. But the dogged determination and not giving up is still there, if you see what I mean, and that's what I get. I get my work ethic from my dad and the determination from my mum, if you see what I mean. So she's still alive. She's 89. She's still living on her own, you know, until before lockdown. She was still getting taxis and going to Sainsbury's on her own, even though probably in reality she was probably not able to do that, but she, you know, physically, but she was hanging in there doing it.
Good,
so, you know, fair play to her. So she'll be 90 in November. So, yeah, so we're kind of made of strong Irish stuff, rightly or wrongly, but it does come with issues.
Oh dear. And you touched on your mental health and you're still learning about it, as is everyone. Again, there's no sort of right or wrong ways to deal with that. So how are you currently dealing with that in compared to how you was dealing with it? Because I would imagine with all that you had on the amount of pressure you had on your shoulders, it was a lot.
Yeah, I think I think initially when I was younger, there was only one way to deal with it. You know, you just got up and got on with it. And that was it. And if anything, you probably pushed it down and just got on with it. And by keeping busy, then you don't have time to think about it. But I've done counselling. I do listen to a lot of audiobooks, not as much now because I'm not as much in the car. But if you know, I'd recommend people that if they are in the car, you know, turn off Radio 1 or 2 and turn on Audible and listen to some stuff for $7.99 a month. You can listen to a new book a month for your $7.99, I think it is, and it's absolutely brilliant. Stuff that I've just recently listened to, which was really interesting, was quite a few things. There's a guy called John D. Martini, and he does The Values Factor. That's a pretty awe-inspiring listen. And Harv T. Ecker, Millionaire Mindset. Now, Millionaire Mindsets sounds all pretentious about money and millionaires and everything else, but actually you couldn't be farther from the truth, really, to be honest. It's all about mindset and doing those kind of things. But and the one of the funniest ones I've listened to recently, which is absolutely brilliant, is Paul Mahoney, I don't know how you pronounce that, Time Management. He takes the piss of the Catholic religion, and as an Irishman, you know, it's actually really funny. So he says that it's all about God, which is not God. It's get one done, basically, if you see what I mean.
Yeah.
But anyway, sorry, we're going off topic.
No, that's fine. That's fine.
So I am actually having a bit of counselling at the moment. I'm not scared or ashamed to say that. So I'm doing a bit of counselling at the moment, which is helping me through some of my issues. It's mindset, values, kind of helping me find who I am a bit more, if you see what I mean. Yeah. And I've got it through my AXA Healthcare that I pay for through my limited company and my property limited company. So property limited companies can provide you other benefits than just tax advantages, if you see what I mean. You know, you can do your own healthcare through them and things like that, look after your kids and things like that, which is what I do. Some of my profits, because I put it through my business in terms of my healthcare gets paid for by my property business, and my kids can be on that healthcare. So there is other benefits that you can use when you run your own limited company. You see what I mean? So yeah, so I'm doing it through that, and it's quite good.
So how are you finding that at the minute? How long have you been doing it as well?
I think it's a course of about 8. I'm about a third of the way through. It's quite good. Challenging, as these things are meant to be, yeah. Aren't they really? So going back to your childhood, going through some of your relationships, going through how you dealt with them and things like that. So that was it's been quite good, helping you with some of kind of positive statements and things like that, if you see what I mean.
So what sort of exercises are they getting you to do to sort of
deal I think the problem I've always had in terms of the mental health and trying to stay present. Because I automatically flip into task mode. Right, what do we need to do? When do we need to do it? Let's get on and do it. As opposed
to... Is that because you're always thinking of the next thing to do?
Yeah, I've got... my brain literally doesn't stop. I mean, I am... I've got a very creative mind. I think in pictures. Right. So when I look at a set of plans, or I look at a house or anything else, I can picture the kind of things of how it's going to look in the end. I can move things around visually. And, I love inventing kind of stuff. So I am a bit of a mad inventor in the background as well, if you see what I mean. So when I was 17, this is going back for people that for the oldies now, in the News of the World Sunday magazine, tell how long ago it was, there was something about if you want to do an invention or we'll help you get an invention done. So I invented a ceramic car heater. I was 18, so I'm 53 now. So that's quite a long time ago now. drew all the plans with the wiring diagrams, everything else. And then he said he wanted, I think it was £800 to start the patent and start getting the paperwork done and getting it going. Well, £800, probably 35, 40 years ago, they might have said £1 million, really, to be honest. It was kind of impossible. Anyway, so that was left there. 2 years later, opened the same News of the World Sunday magazine, and there was my invention, millimeter perfect, sold to the whole of the UK nation in the News of the World magazine.
No way.
I couldn't do anything because I think that was the company. So I've got one of the reasons I went into property was to release me from the day job, to give me that passive income, to give me that financial security, to give me that steady income and base that only property can do. You know, compare it to crypto or compare it to stocks and shares. Property is the only thing that if you put £25 in, you get capital interest on 100. There's nothing else that does that. You're getting capital interest and growth on banks' money. Everyone say the banks are horrible. Well, if they lend you 75% of your property and you get capital growth on their money, that's pretty damn good. Yeah. And I don't think many people really get that or appreciate that actually that's good debt, and good debt creates long-term financial growth, if you see what I mean. So I wanted to try and create that portfolio after the catalyst of Carillion going bust, me not really having any pension. I wanted to create my pension, do all of that, and then give up the day job out of the confrontational industry that I'm in, manage it correctly in my way so I could look after the subcontractors, give them a fair wage for a fair day's work, be interested in them, create fantastic places for people to live, to stay, to holiday in, and so that I could also maybe take out of my head that have been spinning around for the last 30 years some opportunities to see if some of those madcap inventions would actually work, so I could do it. And so that was one of the other reasons I wanted to go into property, to give me that passive income and give me that long-term financial security.
So, I mean, you're one of the safest bets, really, aren't you? If anyone's listening and they're looking to put some money into a project, for example, you've got the ideal person, really, because they've been through it all. They know exactly millimetre by millimetre of the building. Realistically, you're the man to go to.
Yeah, I mean, this sounds incredibly arrogant, and it really isn't meant to be arrogant, but kind of nothing really scares me in a building project, because for lots of reasons. Is one, I've probably done it in my main day job. Two, I know loads of contractors, often national contractors, that can deliver that solution to that problem. And three, it's because I understand whatever that problem is, it's not perceived as a big problem. So therefore, I don't get stressed about it. This will sound extremely arrogant, but it really isn't really meant to be arrogant. But because I've worked on very large projects. So, for example, if you've got, say, like an old office building in the centre of a town or on an estate or something like that, or maybe, say, like a four-storey old kind of doctor surgery or something like that, and you wanted to turn that into, say, a supported living place, which is something I'd really like to do, or wanting to turn it into flats or wanting to turn it into something like that. And then maybe it was a flat roof office burning and you wanted to put two stories on top of it, if you sort of mean through your permit development. I know steel companies that can put the two stories on. I know crane companies that can lift it all up. I know cladding companies. I know kind of dry lining companies got 20 plasterers. I know M&E companies that got 20 and 30 electricians and plumbers. I know designers, acousticians, architects, engineers, damp-proofing specialists, asbestos cleaning up companies. But for me to try and do like my I've got a YouTube channel. So if people tap in something like Chris Sheeran Derelict HMO, something like that, you'll get like a set of 15, 16 videos. And I try to record every week. So often it's harder for me to find one plumber and deal with one plumber. And often I'm educating the plumbers and the painters and the chippies because I tell you a funny story. I was doing a little buy-to-let in Wales.
Yeah.
And it's nearing completion, this being painted, right? And I'm looking at the skirting board, looking at painting, and the painting is shocking.
Yeah.
I mean, I literally could have blindfolded myself and done that and come out with a better job without even seeing what I was doing, right? So I'm saying to this painter, I went, look, come and have a look at this skirting board. He said, why? I said, look, I want you to get up close to have a look at this skirting board. He said, what? I said, this skirting board, this is a new piece of skirting board. This skirting board came into this property bare and clean and smooth. There was no indentations. It was a lovely planed piece of skirting board. So why now is it attached to the wall with drips, dots, dust, gouges out of it? And he looked at me and he went, it's only a rental house. And I went, would your missus be happy with this level of painting in this skirting board? And he looked at me and went, it's only a rental house. Then I looked back up in, because I was on my knees trying to get him to come down and look at how badly this was painted, right? And I looked at him and thought, do you know what? I'm asking the wrong bloke, because if she's living with that, she'd probably put up with anything, to be honest.
I hope you didn't pay him for that. I know it's going to sound really bad, really, any builders listening, or painters. I hope you didn't pay him for that. That's terrible.
Yeah, shocking. So I had to, we hadn't appointed a painter, we'd appointed a building contractor and he was doing it all. So I literally had to hound the builder down to the point to get him there and go, look, this is not acceptable. And actually, one of the guys that knew him very well, that wasn't a painter but was doing something else on it, actually, you know, talked him into coming because he didn't want to know, and got him back. And then we got somebody else. He got another guy in, and it was the classic scenario that all little builders do. So they grow up doing really nice jobs, doing good quality jobs, because they're often very involved on a day-to-day hands-on kind of process. Because they're doing really nice jobs, they get more and more work. So then what they do is they get more and more people that they don't know intimately involved in the jobs, because Fred says, go and get Joe the painter, because I know he's a good painter. Oh yeah, great, brilliant. And oh, I need a chippy. Does anybody know chippy? Oh yeah, get Joe from, yeah, he'll come and do it. And so he hasn't generally proved and vetted and checked all of these people, but he's got all these investors saying, well, can you come and do this job for me? Can you come and do the job? So they all come along, and then he spreads so thin, he ends up running around all the jobs, not managing them properly. He's now completely devoid because he thinks he's made it, because he's now managing 10 buy-to-let refurbs or a couple of HMO refurbs. But he's lost control, and he's lost control of the timing, the management, the money, and most importantly, the quality. And so what tends to happen is that, you know, he then loses lots of stuff. And then what happens is the investor goes, well, this isn't good enough. I'm not paying you. because this is shite. You're doing a rubbish job. The job I looked at, the job I went to look at 3 months ago was gorgeous. That this is not the same job. He said, oh, I've been busy. Sorry. So the guys need paying, even if they're rubbish. So they've demanded paying. He's then potentially got to pay some other people or try and get them back. They go, oh, sod it, fuck off. They leave because they weren't that good anyway. And then he ends up in cash flow problems and goes bust. And then it's Joe the Builder 2023 version. Let's start again. Let's go again. Goes bust and start again. So many times
I've heard, like, one of my good friends, he paid for a refurb up front, all of it up front. And what happened was the builder cash flowed the other properties.
Yes.
And then it overrun. And what you're saying is so true.
And then he was hoping for that property to get another one to get paid for that. And then at some point people, I mean, you know, I mean, I'm not proud. I mean, I've done, you know, 300, 400 million pound, 50 million pound jobs in the day job. But, you know, I got it wrong with a builder and he took me and my ex-partner for 10 grand or whatever. But we didn't pay it all because we refused to pay it all. We paid a little bit and a little bit. And then we weren't getting the results and then couldn't get hold of him. And interestingly enough, it was the agent that told us, the estate agent, letting agent, that told us the builder went bust. So the really interesting thing about that is that the jobs I went to see were good. Mm. You know, they were genuinely good jobs. He was doing a genuinely good job. Really nice finish. So some people don't even go to builders' previous jobs and have a look at them, if you see what I mean, yeah? But I would recommend that that's essential that you do that. You've got to take your references. You've got to do your due diligence. But even a good guy can go bad, not through his own actions. Well, it is his actions because it's his lack of actions, but it's the people that he's brought on board to try and help him because he's a thingy of his own success or whatever, you know?
The victim of his own success.
Yeah, and so that's really important to try and understand when you're getting a builder to do your refurbs. How often is he going to be there? Making sure that if you're going to be a remote investor, if you sort of mean, and you're talking to a builder and you've got it through a sourcer, and the sourcer is going to organise the builder, and it's all brilliant because you think it's fantastic. The sourcer's got me a great property. He's organising the refurb. He's doing this. He's doing that. This is brilliant. Hands off. Superb. Unless you see week by week the photos and look at get a video call. Definitely get a video call. And then as he's on the video, you can say, stop a minute. What? Right, can you step, right, can you go back over, look at the window? Why? Well, I just noticed something in the video. I just need to have a look at the window again. Yeah, it's all in. No, I don't think it was in. I think, you know, can we go zoom back? Can we have a look at the window? And the windows are fitted or something, or there's no glass in it or something, but he's told you the window's fitted or he's, you know, done it. So I've heard a couple of people say recently on some property forums that they kept paying and then he kept forgetting to do the videos. Whenever he agreed to do the videos, he was called away somewhere else and he couldn't do the videos. Essential, get your, if you're going to do that, and it can work very successfully, get him, the guy, the boss, to walk round the house every week, if not twice a week, and take a view. So if I'm the builder and you're on the video call, you don't want to be seeing me. You've got to turn the camera around so you're seeing the property and he walks you around the property. Yeah. You look up at the ceiling, you look down at the skirting boards. You look at where he's got, you check all the things. You go outside, go to the back of the garden, look at the back of the house. Go outside the front door, go to the other side of the road, look back at the house, you know. Get it to do every two or three days, every week. And if you don't get and work out stage payments, I won't pay you until you've done this. And if he says, well, just do 20%, 20%, 20%, or, you know, go or separate into 6 weeks or whatever, say, well, what are you going to do by week one? What are you going to do by week two? If he doesn't know what he's going to do every week, he doesn't know what he's doing. He's just chaotically trying to do it all.
Is it your job as the investor to have the schedule of work set out?
It's essential that he gives you the confidence that he knows what he's doing. And the only way he can prove what he's doing is he's going to kind of write it down. Because if he says it's going to be 8 weeks, he'll know that it might be 8 weeks, because generally they all happen to 8 weeks. But if his chippy disappears off to another job, or the electrician gets ill or something, has he got another electrician? Has he got another chippy? But if he doesn't know that when his chippy's off for that week, that's critical, because if the chippy doesn't put, if the electrician, say, doesn't put in first fix electrics or first fix plumbing, then the plasterers can't finish and they can't do it. And so they can't get the radiators on because they can't plaster the walls because the pipes aren't in the wall, or the wires aren't in and stuff like that. They can't do the plastering. But if that guy disappears, he knows, he should know that some things, if you don't do them in order, you can do them later on. But some things are critical for the order. So if the plumber doesn't get the pipes in the wall, the electrician doesn't get the pipe, the wires under the floorboards and in the ceilings, then if he misses that week, that's what they call a critical path activity, which means that's an extra week on the end. He can't catch it up because everybody stopped. Certain things stopped the whole job. Like, for example, when I was doing my HMO, I had replaced all the windows, but on the front, I had grey windows. I had grey windows and a grey door because it looked looks the dog's bollocks. And the valuer is doing your BRR, or, you know, buy, refurbish, finance, rent. So it's the valuer you're impressing first.
Yeah.
So to clean up the front of the house and make sure you put a brand new door on it. 600 quid from DoorFit UK, 600 quid for a new door, whatever, that might make you £1,000 extra valuation or whatever. So first impressions count and valuations count and everything else. But all the rest of my windows were in, all done. Pretty much it was a 6-bed HMO. So the loft was 2 bedrooms in the loft, bedroom on the first floor, 2 bedrooms on the first floor, 2 bedrooms on the ground floor. But the 2 bedrooms on the front were delayed because the grey windows didn't turn up, because there was a supply shortage for grey resin in the pandemic and this, that and the other. You get white windows, couldn't get grey windows, right? So basically, those 2 rooms, the rest of the job was 90% finished, but those 2 rooms got delayed, and that took 3 weeks from when those windows went in, because they had to skim them, they had to finish them, they had to then do the second fix electrics because some of the electrics and everything were on the outside wall. You can't finish the ceiling until you got the walls in. You can't finish the skirting boards until you got the walls in. You can't return the ceilings. We could have done certain things, but we didn't for certain other reasons. The scaffold was left up because it couldn't put the windows in. Because we were doing roof works as well, fascias and everything else. And so it's important that your builder knows what the critical activities are. Because if they don't know what the critical activities are, then he can't give you confidence in when he's going to finish, if you saw what I mean. And he's got to have enough people. So if he's relying on one electrician and one plumber, and that's all he's got, what happens if something awful happens? What happens if not even the plumber or electrician? What happens if the plumber or electrician's mum or dad or sister or brother has a problem? He's got to look after the family, and that's what he should be doing. But that means you don't have plumbing or electrics. So ask your builder, how many electricians have you got? How many plumbers have you got? How many roofers have you got? How many plasterers have you got? So when one gets ill or has to go away or gets pulled away on another job and doesn't come, who's the substitute? Who's going to come in and keep your job? And find out what he does as your builder. Is he a plumber? Is he an electrician? Is he a chippy? What is he by trade, if you sort of mean?
So obviously we know that you're an expert in construction, obviously the architect, and obviously property now as well. So what's the goal sort of moving forward for you?
So at the moment, what we're doing at the moment is I've got my HMOs running, I've got my buy-to-lets running. They're all running really well. They're all managed by agents, so it's a proper passive income, if you see what I mean. If people are interested in learning about HMOs, look at my YouTube channel. But get a WhatsApp group up for every HMO. It's hilarious. Because you can watch all the shenanigans, but you're never named on the group. So somebody else has to set up the group and invite you as the landlord, but you never answer. You never answer. You can see all of the shenanigans going on. It's hilarious. Anyway, but as long as you've got an agent to deal with it, it's fine. So what we're doing now is the two things I want to do is we're now looking and we're just about to start some projects for high-end, five-star luxury, large holiday lets. So, for example, I don't know how big your family is, but for example, if you've got like three or four groups of your mates with their kids, you all book the large holiday let. So it will kind of sleep 16 or 20. You've got the large banquet dining table that's about 4 or 5 meters long. Everybody can go and have, you know, the dinner with some fancy kind of stuff with the lights over it and it all looks good. You've got the hot tub outside, nice furniture, barbecue, en suites, maybe the odd roll top bath in the middle of the bedroom or whatever, you know, proper luxury. And when we get those going, so we're looking for investors for long-term funding, if you see what I mean. So 5, 3, 5, 6, 7 years to put their money in and get a great return over that. So if they're time poor, we can include them involving and keep them updated or not, if it depends what you want to do. And then what I'd really like to do is going back to my childhood kind of thing. So the purpose of the holiday lets is to give people phenomenal holiday experiences. Something that I never had as a kid. I never really went on holiday as a child. I brought my kids to fantastic places and stuff like that. But I want to kind of that whole multi-generational holiday and thing like grandma, granddad, the kids, the kids' kids, things like that. That's what we're going to try and create, some really special places, generally in things around lakes, in mountains, in forests, those kind of things. Like your individual centre park building.
Yeah.
Or to yourself, if you see what I mean, yeah? And then cinema rooms, games rooms, the full works. But then, interestingly enough, once we've got those going, what I would really like to do as well, because I've been involved in a little bit of it, but it's really difficult, is to do the supported living stuff. So what I'd really like to do is to do the supported living and, strangely enough, bring these two relative opposite strategies together. So in the really low weeks, because you will get low weeks in your large holiday lets, allow the people in the supported living, so people recovering from drugs, alcoholism, mental health issues, things like that, bring them to the luxury holiday let and let them experience like two or three nights of luxury and go, look, this is, when you get yourself sorted, this is your future. You can do this. You can go and do these things and give them an opportunity, or give them a kind of a vision and a future, if you see what I mean. And those two kind of completely polarized opposite ends of the property strategy could be kind of linked together. And the reason I'm not just going to do the supported living is, if anybody knows anything about supported living, it's getting easier now in the last couple of years. But it's a really difficult strategy to work. because you've got, you know, you've got the local councils that have got the people that need the help. Then often you need registered care providers, but then often you'll often have to have a registered landlord or a registered housing provider, like a housing association. You then need to do the building up to a proper standard. And the ideal scenario would be like an old office building or something like that, that you could turn into supported living, semi-independent flats. But then you would have large communal areas, so they could all get together. They could be taught how to cook. They'd be taught how to live independently. They could have positive growth type sessions in there. I got very close to running and creating something like that down in Devon with a charity. And the person that was selling the property just sold it three times. Every time he came back to me and I said, yeah, I'll buy it. And then as we were going, he said, no, I've sold it to somebody else for more money. Then he came back and he went, and then he came back and then he went. And by the time he came back the fourth time, I was in my HMOs and I had no money to buy it. So I had to let it go. So I had the charity set up. I had loads of things set up, but or some of it set up. What I learned really since then is that, in all honesty, I didn't have it all set up, and I probably needed another couple of people or organisations involved in it. But so that's what I'd like to do. So that's my kind of vision. And then a little bit about that we were just laughing about before we came on. I am actually a massive petrol head. So, and strangely enough, massively into my sustainability. So I know about solar panels, ground source heat pumps, air cooling, you know, insulation, battery systems, carbon zero homes, all that kind of stuff. So although I'm massive into sustainability, I do have a problem where I do like to burn petrol. But I like to think that I save enough of it to go mad occasionally, if you see what I mean. So what I'd really like to do is have the time to do investor days, get a Caterham or a Westfield, and bring all of my investors and other people and run like a little motorsports business to teach people how to drive around a track. Because whenever I've taken my mates out, when I used to have a kit car before I had to sell it through the divorce, people loved it because I just tell them to go faster and faster and faster. And they like look at me and going, faster? I went, yeah, floor it. No, you know, brake, turn in, floor it, come in, apex, rise, throttle down, up, love it. So so I'd like to run that as well, to be honest. So that's the vision, really.
That's absolutely fantastic. I mean, how long do you think that's going to take? I can't see that taking you long, because obviously you're going to get it done. Honestly,
I think at the moment, I do my holiday let business with a friend of mine that I used to work with in a previous construction company, a guy called Matt Cardozo. So me and Matt are looking at a number of properties now, and we could look like, if things happen this week, we could have potentially three properties. We'd have an old church in Scotland, which would be phenomenal, which would be an amazing project to do. We've got an old pub in Wales, which has got a massive field. So we could do that, a holiday let, and then turn that into a fantastic glamping scenario as well. And then we've got one, hopefully we'll get it offer agreed to tomorrow, I think, hopefully. Nice, large old three-stroke stone building, which will be like a nice eight-bed sleep 16 holiday let or whatever, which should be going through. So we've potentially got those three going on. So it would be really good to, it would definitely ease the pressure if anybody out there is looking for some interesting investments and would love to be part of the journey of turning these places into, you know, luxury high-end facilities. And then once those are up and going, then I can say goodbye to the partial day job. So I work some of the week as a project manager, client side project manager for a large government organisation, the Atomic Energy Authority, which we're doing like £200-300 million worth of redevelopment. So it'd be nice to say goodbye there and concentrate 100% on the property. And then once I'm doing that, then we'll get the car racing and the supported living going as well.
I'm looking forward to that, mate. Do you know what? It's been absolutely fantastic. Obviously getting to know you a little bit better and learning about your life and where you've obviously come from, going through the divorce, learning about obviously every single part of your life, the pressure, obviously the struggles you've gone through as well. And then obviously going into property, the struggles you had to deal with builders. As I can guarantee everyone that's been in property and involved in property, you'll have a problem with a builder at some point. If you don't, then send me their number.
It's not an if, it's a when.
Yeah.
You will.
1,000,000%. But Chris, you've been fantastic. Where can people reach out to you?
So if you connect on my Facebook, it's just Chris Sheeran on my normal profile. I've got a Facebook group called Verve Property Community, which currently is public, so you can go and join that. If you tap into YouTube and you want to look at any of my videos of the buildings and the HMOs I've done and any of the advice on property investing, again, that's just Chris Sheeran, GMAC Developments and Verve Property. So if you tap in something like Chris Sheeran, so Sheeran is spelled Sheerin, similar to Ed Sheeran, but Sheeran. But half my family is Sheerins, half my family is Sheerans. So theoretically, I may or may not be related to good old Ed. But anyway, that's for another day. if you tap in something like Chris Sheeran, HMO, derelict HMO, then there's a load of videos you can go and watch me take you through week by week how we took a 3-bed old semi that was fairly run down into a high-end luxury kind of industrial design kind of HMO, 6-bed HMO with 4 en suites and a shared bathroom with luxury kitchen and things like that.
Fantastic. Chris, you've been amazing. I really appreciate you coming on. And like I say, if anyone's got any other questions, please go and visit Chris, message him, and obviously go and watch his YouTube. He's one of the most intelligent people that I've come across, and I've watched his YouTube videos. Also, I know Chris, and I can 100% guarantee he will know the answer to it. And if he doesn't, as he's previously mentioned, he will find it out. So, guys, thank you very much for listening. You've been amazing. I'll speak to you soon.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Connect You podcast. If you've enjoyed this episode, please share this on your socials, tag me, and leave a review.